Good morning! This is Ian McNeice, or otherwise Winston Churchill. That's right, the good old Winston Churchill from Doctor Who. And you are listening to Too Much Scrolling. I'll see you in the future.
Welcome to Too Much Scrolling for January 25th, 2022. I'm Steve Fodor.
I'm Chip Hessenflow.
And I'm Pam Bedore.
Hey, Pam's here. It must be the end of the month. Time for our literary bills to come due. The end of the month, Pam comes in and talks books with us. How you doing, Pam?
I'm doing great. I'm not sure if I like this, like, bills coming due. Come on, man. This was an awesome book this week.
We'll get to our book in a few minutes. Chip, how are you doing?
Oh, I'm doing well, Steve. I've been out shoveling snow because, you know, in North Carolina, it's what we do.
Get the beet juice. Everybody get some beet juice. Throw it on the street.
There was actually real snow this last night. We had kids out in the middle of the street, and they were sliding down the street because we got hills everywhere around here. And one of the questions I asked was, hey, listen, how many snows have you experienced in your life? And the young man, I guess he's 8, said two snows, Steve.
Nice. It's awesome.
Well, I'm a little jealous because we don't have any snow.
You also don't have a coat.
I have a coat. I just haven't had any need to wear it yet.
Film at 11.
Brings us to our film at 11, our movie of the week. This week, Chip, it has been musical production week for Steve's World, and Steve has not seen a TV. What have you seen this week?
Steve, I got to see a reading film.
A foreign film. These films are made by people in other countries that may or may not speak English, and this film is not in English. You got to see Delicious.
Yes, and they speak a form of Spanish from France.
Pam, are you familiar with French?
Maybe a little bit.
Oui, oui. Oui, oui.
Was it called Delicious or Delicieux?
It is, well, the second one.
We talked about this one a little bit last week. So tell us all about this movie again, Chip.
It's about a black cat who somehow gets a white stripe painted down its back. And this skunk chases it around the entire film. It was incredible.
It's all about sexual harassment in the animal kingdom.
Little Pepe Le Pew. This is a wonderful film. In fact, this is a great film, and I highly recommend this. I'll go ahead and say this is probably 80 out of 100 as far as how good this film was. This is it ends, by the way, with a guillotine. So, you know, you can't go wrong there. This is
a what now?
A guillotine.
How do you say that, Pam?
A guillotine?
Well, hey. I'm from the South. I can barely speak English as it is. Come on.
Much less French.
That's right. Much less French. This takes place in 1789 in France, and it is just before the Revolution. The movie starts off with a dinner at a sort of an aristocrat's home. It starts out with this man carefully preparing the food. He is our chef. He runs this beautiful kitchen. And he's going to bring in the potato dish, which someone doesn't like. And basically, they mock him and they fire him. And he heads out and says, I will never cook again. And ultimately, he opens a restaurant for the everyday person, for the bourgeois. And anyway, this is a really nice film. It is beautiful as far as the setting. It is beautiful and as far as the thoughts that go through it. And I love the color palette they used. I like the setting. There was a number of times where I felt the director was using some still life painting as inspiration for a setting. And I recommend this. This was a reading film. This is you're going to be reading subtitles. Very, very good.
There's some beautiful films that are centered on food. And I love when a cinematographer thinks about the framing of a table full of delicious food and shows it to an audience like this.
It's the preparation, Steve. It's for all those people who love the Food Network. What can I say?
There you go. You are absolutely right. I do love watching the Food Network when they do those shows that show off the talent of those chefs.
So we have this wonderful film I'm recommending to everyone, but we've got a whole bunch of movies that don't look very good, Steve.
It is certainly the end of January. It is certainly the doldrums of film releases. You dug deep to find some titles that are opening this week.
Steve, you got one for like people who love pop stars?
Yes, there is a new global pop star named Charlie XCX. She's British. She's got a new album called How I'm Feeling Now, and she wrote it during the quarantine of COVID-19, and here is the movie about the production of this album. It's called Charlie XCX Alone Together.
How about a movie for people who like grumbly voices?
How about a grumbly voice garbage man? This one is called Clean. It is the story of a garbage man whose name is Clean, who is trying to find a quiet life and redemption, and it doesn't work out well.
How about a film maybe set in an exotic location that's kind of surreal that we really don't know what's going on?
Well, there's a Tim Roth movie called Sundown. This is the story of a family that is in turmoil. They go on vacation in Mexico, and then there's a lot of family drama that goes on with the possibilities of what money could do to a family.
There's higher hopes in this film, just so you know. But the next film, it looks like that takes place maybe at, an ocean location, but it looks clueless.
This one is called The Requin, and yes, Chip, it stars Alicia Silverstone that you might remember from Clueless or Batgirl.
And just so you know, I think that Shark and Jaws, I think he's being typecast.
This is a Shark Jaws silly movie produced by Saban Films. So that's all you really need to know is the Mighty Morphin Power Rangers production company made a shark movie. You can guess what it's like.
What is Netflix giving us this week, Steve?
Yeah, there's Home Team on Netflix this week. This is Kevin James, one of Adam Sandler's favorite buddies to make movies with. And he is playing disgraced NFL coach Sean Payton, who got suspended from the NFL for a year and went back home and used his time to coach his son's football team. This is a very silly rendition of that true life story, a very Adam Sandler version of that without Adam Sandler. So that's why it's not filmed in a exotic Hawaiian location, Chip.
Well, that makes a lot of sense there.
But Rob Schneider still shows up. So as long as you have Rob Schneider and Kevin James, you're fine.
Then you can do it.
You can do it.
Book it.
Brings us to our book of the week. The reason why Pam is here is because we are getting so much enlightenment from our discussions over so many great books over the last, almost 2 years now, Pam, since we started talking about great literature. This month, you have brought us To Say Nothing of the Dog. This was published in 1997, the late 1900s, by Connie Willis.
Well, and I have to tell you guys, this is one of my all-time favorite books. I don't mind if you guys didn't like it, but this is one of those books where if I just have like 10 minutes and, you know, don't have anything to do, I will sometimes just open this novel anywhere and read for 10 minutes. It's just one of my this book is a pleasure from start to finish. And it's just a super fun book, but it's also really kind of deep. So I'm so curious, what did you guys think of this one?
I can see why you love this so much.
That's this not the same as saying you liked it.
Thank you for decoding that. I can see this is a time travel based Victorian era story. It is so Victorian for so very long. I know how much you love the Victorian era, and this spends a lot of time looking at what life was like specifically in 1888. And I, the whole time I was reading this, I was thinking, yep, I see why Pam loves this. What did you think, Chip?
Oh, yeah, no. I read it. This was, not my cup of tea. Okay. And I don't know if it was because it was written in 1997, but I just wasn't feeling it. I felt I was going through a slog, and it was not my favorite. And by all means, I'm not judging. I'm just saying that I just didn't feel it as I was reading it.
This is the second in the series. Does the series have a name?
No, and they're not in any order.
Okay.
So, these are just the like time travel books that are set at Oxford with Professor Dunsworthy, and basically Doomsday Book is about the Black Plague pandemic, and then Blackout and All Clear about World War II. And then To Say Nothing of the Dog is Victorian. So they're like time travel to these different periods. So,
and all four books in the series won the Hugo Award. That makes Connie Willis the first author to win Hugo Awards for all the books in a series. These are Hugo Award winning books. And as I have said in the past, I usually don't enjoy the Hugo Award winning books. There's something about the style that committee enjoys that is not my style.
Okay. I should have been more careful with this recommendation. It's funny because the four books are so different from one another.
Okay.
And this is my personal favorite of the series. A lot of people like Doomsday better, but yes, among my friends, these are very, very popular, fun books that people really enjoy. So
I was listening to a better podcast this week, and they mentioned the Doomsday Book, but not the Connie Willis Doomsday Book. And then one of the participants on the podcast went, oh, the Connie Willis book? And they went, no, the actual Doomsday Book from the 1700s. Oh, that's a different conversation.
Right. So, so this is very interesting. Now, in terms of time travel, Steve, how did you like the mechanism? I know you're a time travel guy.
I always wonder about the mechanism for the time travel as the author imagines it. And this one has just a portal. It is not a vehicle. And they give us the rules of the time travel. They say that nothing can be brought back to the future from the past, but that is the crux of the problem in this story, is that something has been brought back, and then they have to figure out what to do about it, because that has caused a huge disruption in the time-space continuum, as far as they know. And I'm curious about the perspective of the narrator, how he knows this disruption, because in some time travel stories, you wouldn't be aware of a disruption, because when a time event happens, there's some paradox that could occur, and you can't know what happened once it's happened. You only know your timeline of events.
Right. And so the net is such a funny technology that I really enjoy. And again, this is the one thing that those four loosely connected novels in the series have in common, is that they use the net as a portal to the past. And I really love this sort of history of the net, which is that it was funded by multinationals who were hoping to be able to bring objects from the past forward and make enormous profits from them. And then when they realized that the net just wouldn't open in the past, if you tried to bring forward like famous artworks that have since been destroyed, they just sort of lost interest and I don't know, donated the technology to Oxford University, who uses it in their history department. So they, you know, the system is actually really kind of a humorous, but also sort of critical commentary on like, who controls technology? You know, all of the questions that she's interested in, like, are the same questions we ask about space travel, right?
And it's interesting that she gives the net this power, that the net is deciding, that there is a personification of history, of time, that is deciding what should and shouldn't happen. That was an interesting piece of this story.
And you know that there are problems when there's a lot of slippage. So if you set up the net to send you back to like August 1st, 1888, and you arrive and it's August 4th, you know there's a problem.
and history and time are trying to solve that problem by causing this problem with the time travel itself. That's a very interesting way of thinking that she wrote into this. On top of that, the beginning of this story, our narrator is time lagged. He does not have the ability to actually tell us what's really happening. He's mishearing things. He's misreporting. I love a story with an unreliable narrator. That beginning of this story where I knew that what I was being given might not be the truth was fascinating to me.
And you know, that's one of my favorite things, but Chip, I have a feeling that's not one of your favorite things.
It was not. And I think the challenge, I had a hard time getting into this story, and I kept thinking, all right, so something's going to really happen. I eventually stopped. I went to the Wikipedia page and just started reading it to be able to get the outline of what was going to happen. And
disconcerted then.
Yeah, this was just, it's not my genre, and it just didn't grab me. And in fact, I mean, I eventually just put it down and I went to other books. I read two books this week in addition to this one. But this one really, I just kept going and going and saying, okay, so when am I supposed to kick this in? And just, it really wasn't working for me.
I wonder if that goes back to your desire to have an action adventure in your stories. A lot of these stories that we've read together, you are always looking for the story, the action. Where is this going to happen? And this is very Victorian, this writing. It meanders through all of these relationships with all of these families and you know, the cat. Oh my goodness, the cat. And how these people interact.
I don't know, the people yelling to each other back and forth. Like, I mean, it was just like, what was that all about? And it just, and what I thought was, it was trying to be clever and trying to bring humor in, but I wasn't buying the humor. I was like, just get me to the next thing. And I'm just wondering if it was 1997 writing style, as opposed to, you said Victorian, versus something that would be written today. Listen, every book doesn't have to be a Michael Crichton Jurassic Park, where you're like racing through things. But it just, this movie it didn't grab me. And I knew it. And I just kept getting, you know, just kind of lost in it, and to the point where I wasn't even paying attention. I was just reading to read, going, I've got to get through this. And I wasn't connecting with it.
Oh, Chip, I'm so sorry I gave you this experience.
This wasn't your fault. There's millions of books out there. No one said that every book has to be your favorite. I tried reading Lord of the Rings, I don't know, 4 or 5 times before I got through it. And finally, I got through it, and I enjoyed it. I don't know if I'd ever re-experience it. And I felt similar to this. I just kind of kept getting lost in it and not really connecting with it. That's okay. I mean, that's the beautiful part of it. That's okay.
One of the things about recommending this book, and you guys are the first people I've recommended it to who didn't like it. So this is really interesting, because I've recommended this book dozens of times. I mean, I read it when it came out in 97. But here's the problem with recommending something that's written in a completely Victorian style is that it's huge, right? Yeah. So this is very much written in the style of a Victorian novel. And you know that, right? When you first open it up and you get chapter one, a search party, wartime headgear, the problem of nepotism, royal headgear, the bishop's bird stump is missing, jumble sales, a clue to its whereabouts, astronomical observations, dogs, a cat, man's best friend, an abrupt departure. So now that is absolutely what Victorian novels do. They give you the chapter, sometimes it's named, sometimes it isn't, and then they give you the subheadings, the announcements of what is going to happen in this chapter. And it's usually like 10 or 12 different things, and the chapter is 14 pages long. So, and that's part of the pleasure of the Victorian. And obviously Connie Willis is actually like leaning into that even more than most people, but it's more Victorian than a Victorian novel in some ways. It's an exaggeration, but it's still like, that is what you get when you open up your big Dickens novel, when you open up your big Thackeray novel. And it's funny because, I mean, I have a paperback that's 600 pages, but this would have, you know, Victorian novels of this word length, they were actually published in three volumes that were quite large, and they were called triple deckers. And because these Victorian novels, they were supposed to take you some time. This mm-hmm. was a real pleasure that you would take your time over, maybe read it aloud with the family. They're just written in the same style as the Victorian architecture and furnishings that Ned Henry describes so, to me, hilariously. Where like when Ned tries to get through a Victorian room, he's like trying to remember, right? There's a, like this table, the umbrella stand, the fish tank. There's like so many things that you can bump into. And the language of the novels actually mimic the ornate busyness of Victorian architecture and style. And so I remember when I was an undergrad, all of our courses would last two semesters, so English classes. So when I took Victorian Lit, we started in September, we finished in April, and we read one novel a week. So we ended up with 28 of these giant Victorian novels. And so when we used to do our exams, we would have to do exams in the gym. There was this great big arena, and there'd be all different exams were scheduled at the same time, and you'd sit in a row. This is kind of the British system, right? I was in Canada. And so you'd all sit in a row and there'd be proctors all over the place. And so for my Victorian Lit class, the row for us had two desks, one desk for us and one desk for our books because it was an open book exam. And so, I mean, so forgive me for recommending a Victorian style science fiction novel that really plays on the ornateness of the period.
And I think that's what she was going for sure, is she was trying to show us all of those things that Victorian literature brings, that slow reading carefully, understanding these characters. I think that this is not Michael Crichton.
Well, I think you just hit it right there, is that when we're reading, maybe sometimes at the clip we're reading, the reading for pleasure is mm-hmm. not something that, I shouldn't say it. I read for pleasure, but these were meant to, it's meant to take time. It's meant to mm-hmm. kind of read a little bit at a time and kind of contemplate it. And that was not what I was doing. That was not what I was doing at all.
Which is why I texted you 10 days ago to try to get you to start it.
Well, I did. I started it with plenty of time.
It is a slow meandering trip down the Thames. It is exactly that. She is giving us this view of Victorian life with the time travel piece, where they can go back to 1940. They can go back to wherever the time travel is happening. 2040, is that accurate?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And they have that ability, but generally this is a look at Victorian life and those relationships and how that works in that time.
Yeah. As someone who actually loves the Victorian period and has read quite a lot about it, I have a different experience than many, but I like how she sets up the novel, which is that Ned Henry is an expert on the 20th century. So he gets sent to the, he's a time traveler and he gets time traveling historian. He gets sent to the Victorian period as a place of rest. And so he's completely untrained. Now, one of the things that Connie Willis, in my opinion, does really well, but I understand if some people find it super annoying, is that she creates these really frantic pacings around certain issues that aren't terribly important, right? So like Oxford is turned upside down because this woman, Lady Shrapnel, is trying to do this reconstruction and she needs the bishop's bird stump, which is one of the ugliest pieces of art you've ever seen. And no one knows where it is. And so people are just going crazy, traveling everywhere, traveling to, you know, like the medieval period to read about bird stumps and traveling to the Victorian era, trying to catch a glimpse of this piece of artwork, traveling to World War II where it was lost. And these historians are like, this is the most important thing in the world. And like, who cares, right? Like
this is one character. Right,
rich lady who's spending money that could better be spent on addressing the climate crisis, as characters say throughout the novel, in order to create some reconstruction because her great 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 grandmother's life was changed by this stupid artwork. So, but people get so caught up in it. So there's so much like sort of gentle satire about academics, and that's what I enjoy. Right, is that like, I'm that person. I can get super caught up in the fact that I can't find a reference and I've got an article due. What am I going to do? Big schema thing? Who cares? but you still do get caught up in your own little piece of knowledge that matters so much to you when you are an academic.
And as the time travel reader, I was looking for the moment in the narrative where that was going to become important, where Lady Shrapnel made this important because of the interactions that these time travelers had with her ancestors. And I'm like, I'm waiting for it. Like, they're going to write it. They're going to have it put down. Okay, here it is. Aha, that's why it's important, because the grandmother, the great grandmother, said it was important. I love that.
Okay, I'm glad you felt like you did get some.
There's pleasure. Definitely my favorite parts of time travel in this. There's definitely a story about friendships and relationships. I did get quite a bit out of this, and there's quite a bit of comic writing in this that I really enjoyed, very reminiscent of Terry Pratchett. Again, we have not read Terry Pratchett in this book club, and one of these days we will do it, but there's some very funny things that Connie Willis has included here. I love the quote when the young man sees the young lady on the side of the river and says, the young lady had a pretty heart-shaped face and even prettier ankle-shaped ankles. Love that.
Are you allowed to say ankles in Victorian literature?
And that was the joke. That was the joke, is you're not supposed to see her ankles. He's not from that time period, but he's noticing the ankles because that was the most voluptuous part of Victorian dress was, oh, I could see her ankles. Ooh.
On a windswept bridge, Chip, you never know what you might see.
Ooh.
Now, okay, so you guys, forgive me for getting excited, even though you guys aren't, but so one of the problems that our time travelers face is the problem of incongruity, right? So they're constantly worried, like, oh my gosh, we're creating
a paradoxes.
Problem in the timeline. We are actually having a negative impact on time. What if we create an incongruity that, I don't know, like, means that Hitler wins the war. Like, they have all of these different ideas, but it gets really, really meta because the novel, if you enjoy this kind of thing, is so funny. And, you know, humor works in four different ways. And one of them is incongruity. Like, that's one of the things we laugh about, is when something is out of place. Mm-hmm. This is a novel laughing about incongruity while fearing incongruity. Right. And
I agree.
And by the way, I thought the observations about cats and dogs were just amazing. And so maybe this is just me, but when I teach argumentative writing, I always like to teach the thesis using the example of which are better, cats or dogs, because I don't want kids to get like involved with like capital punishment or something that they might actually care deeply about. Like, so, you know, is a hot dog a sandwich? Which is better, cats and dogs? Like, these are the kinds of questions that I like to work on. And the cats and dog one is awesome. And she's playing out this entire novel about the difference between cats and dogs in some sense. And you guys, the dog gets the title to say nothing of the dog, even though one could argue that the cat is the central character.
And it's mentioned like four times in the story. She keeps bringing us back to the title to explain why she titled it To Say Nothing of the Dog, like four times. Like, oh, that's phenomenal. So we should get into our favorite characters, because I think this conversation about cats and dogs is directly tied to the characterizations of who these people are. And a cat person acts this way and a dog person acts that way. I think that's the fun part for me talking about cats and dogs is how that relates to the characters. Our main character is Ned Henry. He is, as you said, a 20th century expert time traveler going back into the Victorian time for a rest. I love that. He needs two weeks
rest. He gets a ton of sleep, you guys.
2 weeks rest. Where can we send him? Oh, let's send him to the Victorian times and give him a mission. That will be relaxing. That's hilarious. That sounds so much like what academics would do on sabbatical, Pam. It's yes! Like, Pam needs a rest. She's going to take a sabbatical. She's only got this many meetings and this many things that she has to get done, because she has to get them done. Otherwise, nobody's going to get them done. Yeah, that's very accurate.
Well, and I just love this setup too. And again, not everyone's cup of tea, but when he's listening to subliminals, but he can't actually take medication because he's already too sick. So he's just listening to tapes about like fish forks and hoop skirts. And Mr. Dunsworth or Professor Dunsworth is talking to him and he's like, okay, Ned, the mission I'm going to give you could mean the end of the world if it fails. The mission is, and then he kind of loses focus and he's like, the fish fork is the one with three tines. And so he gets to the Victorian period and he has no idea what he's supposed to do, but he's got this absurd amount of luggage and he's pretty sure he should stay with the luggage.
And again, that unreliable narrator, I was expecting that to continue throughout the story.
You can only stand it for so long, Steve.
I was the whole time I was thinking, well, what if he's not reporting what's really happening? What if at the end of the novel there's a twist where that didn't really happen? That was just a dream that he had while he was recovering from his time lag. I was waiting for it the whole time. But yes, the every once in a while where Connie Willis throws back in, oh, fish forks, oh, all the things about Victorian era that you don't really know because you didn't study it because you were already too ill. I love that.
And that's a great character. He's so quick on his feet, right? Mm-hmm. So even when he's super time lagged, I mean, he gets really lucky, you guys, to not get caught out. But he's so quick on his feet.
And isn't that a theme here? Aren't we looking at, once again, the idea of fate? The idea of decisions, what decisions can humans really make? And which of those things that are lucky are actually history causing those modifications?
And history protecting itself.
Mm-hmm. So he's the one who really gets to be the friend of the dog. And I got to tell you, Pam, my favorite character in this story is Cyril the dog.
I knew it would be. Cyril is the best.
It's the best character. She writes this character with so much emotion, despite the fact that he doesn't talk. It's not a talking dog, thank goodness. Dog expresses himself with emotion, and she writes those descriptions so well. I love this character.
I do too. And I feel like Ned is someone who's never had a pet before. He knows nothing about animals, but animals know about him. And so immediately, like, Cyril and Ned connect right away. And it's so great because Terrence talks about Cyril. You fully expect Cyril as a person until you meet this bulldog, right? He's like, oh yes, Cyril's watching the boat. We have to do this and this and this and this. And no worries though, Cyril's guarding our luggage. And so then when you actually meet this bulldog and Ned's like, am I just time lagged or is Cyril a dog? It's just fantastic. And then Cyril and Ned bond in this crazy way that makes Ned, you know, this academic, this scholar of history, like realize how much he's missing out on in his life. Mm. That he doesn't have a dog, that he doesn't have a pet, that he doesn't take time to talk to someone who can't talk back. Mm-hmm. And he talks to Cyril constantly. Well, Cyril, I don't know what we're going to do about this time paradox. This could be the end of history.
And again, the way Connie writes it, we have a dialogue without words coming from the dog. The dog is expressing itself in a way that is very well done. Then we get to the cat.
And I know Princess you're a cat Arjuma. Person, Steve. I hear you got a whole pride of cats.
My wife has cats. I live in a house with cats. You are right. I do not qualify myself as a cat person.
You've got a pride of cats in your house, Steve.
Yes.
For not being a cat person, I don't think your lifestyle.
I am a wife person. I love my wife, and whatever animals she wants to bring into the house is fine with me. Don't ever tell her that. She will never listen to this podcast. Princess Arjuman, Tossie's pet cat, is another character that Connie Willis is giving us all of the emotion, all of the dialogue without any words that this animal is giving. But boy, do we understand Tossie. By the way, what kind of a name is Tossie?
It's a Victorian name, Stephen.
Short for Tosselin. Tosselin, everyone. Her nickname is Tossie. And yes, the cat, Princess Arjumand, gets tossed into the river. Uh-huh. I gotcha. Thank you.
And then Verity, who's like amazing. I love Verity. I love this character. The beautiful naiad with the ankle-shaped ankles. She's so great. And even though she 100% knows you can't be changing things when you're in the Victorian period trying to read somebody's diary to find out about this stupid piece of artwork, the bishop's bird stump, you know, she can't help herself. She sees this cat drowning. And she rushes in, which a Victorian lady would never do. She wades into the river and like saves the cat's life, even though you would never ever do that. Now, guys, okay, I thought this book was hilarious all the way through, but there are some dark undercurrents. And the fact is that in 2040, cats are extinct. Mm-hmm. Now,
well, I bet there's 101 ways to deal with that.
Thank you, Jeff.
Just a reminder for those people who remember the past.
But as a cat person myself, that is a devastating statement.
Mm-hmm.
You can still worship them, even if they're not here. They demand it anyway.
Thank you, Cleopatra.
So Verity and Ned have never met cats. They don't know anything about them. And one of the passages that I found the most hilarious was when Ned realizes that for all of these days, he's been wandering the river, trying to figure out what he's supposed to be doing, what the great mission is that he's supposed to be accomplishing. And he's had the cat all along in this covered carpet bag that he assumed contained like a ham or something. And so he's had the cat. And of course, he puts the cat on the ground and she runs off. And so now he doesn't know what to do. And when he talks to Terrence and Professor Pettick and says, so if you were going to find a cat, like, what would you just call its name? And they were like, what? And he's just like, are there commands that you would use with a cat? And Terrence says, it's a cat. And I just love that line because I'm trying to think of how many times I've said that to my kids. Like, no, the cat will not do everything that you wish for it to do. It's a cat. Unlike Cyril the dog, who obediently does whatever you suggest.
I do love the interaction between the animals and the main characters. I do question the naming of Verity. As I pointed out with our last time travel novel, Verity was the name of the woman who created Doctor Who. Uh-huh. Doctor Who would not have existed without Verity, and having a time travel character, a very smart, very pivotal character named Verity in this book, I really think Connie Willis used that name on purpose, and I really think she knows about Doctor Who.
Yes, 100%. No doubt about it.
We get into all the family and all of the different interactions with these characters. Tossie is such a bubble of joy and clearly not the smartest one in the family, and all of these different interactions, very, very Victorian. Going back for a second, the idea of the Victorian house being full of furniture, and Connie writes in the book that you couldn't help but be slow when walking through these rooms, that the Victorian era, it has this pace to it, and maybe it's because they had so much furniture in every room. I love that line.
And then she does that with her words.
Mm-hmm.
Right, describing all of these pieces of furniture. And then one of the things I love is that Tossie keeps a diary, which is like central. They have to find out, who's she going to marry? Who's Mr. C? And so Verity's constantly trying to find the diary, and she's running back and forth between the Victorian period and 2040, and talking to forensics experts who are working with the diary in the 21st century. And so the moment when Ned is with Tossie and all of those sisters, and the sisters who are like a garden of girls, you know, Daisy and Posy and whatever, and Tossie starts describing her dress, and Ned Henry thinks, oh my God, 150 years from now, some poor forensic expert is going to actually decipher exactly what she is saying right now. But that's how history is, right? We get all these documents and we do read all of these not very interesting things to find that kernel that explains everything. That's mm-hmm. the study of history.
And in addition to that, there's so many other themes of this writing. I question the absent-minded professor theme. Do you find that is a realistic thing working in the university system like you do? Are there absent-minded professors like we see described in this book?
Yes. I'd love to be like, no, Steve, that doesn't exist.
That's a trope. It doesn't exist. Did I eat today? No,
the answer is yes.
That's amazing to me. I'm fascinated by tropes like that we've seen throughout literature. There's a real basis for that. There are actual people at the university that are so focused on their genius that they don't do the rest of life.
Oh, Steve, my goodness. You work at a school. You don't have to be a genius. There's absent-minded people all over the place.
There's a difference between absent-minded people and genius really truly focused on their singular duty and neglecting the rest.
I mean, one of the places that I feel like, so I became a prof in 2005, and one of the places that I sort of saw these completely amazing absent-minded professors with a complete focus was back then, there were people who just refused to do email.
Mm-hmm.
They were just like, it takes me out of my work. I'm just not doing it. And mm-hmm. and the modality of it was just antithetical to the research they were doing. Just a fear of losing focus. And I'm probably like at the other end of that spectrum, a little ADHD perhaps, but you know, I'm constantly like doing 1 million things at once. Again, this is what I love about Connie Willis is the frantic pacing of the Academy, but there are lots of people. I would never like forget to eat lunch. That's never happened to me, but
chocolate break.
Right. Exactly.
Lots of cheese balls.
But people do it. People do get caught up in their projects and kind of the rest of the world disappears.
Some of the other themes, class is once again on display here. This is a very Victorian concept, and looking at it from a 1997 perspective, she gives us some very interesting ideas about who these people are based on their birth.
Yeah. And Ned has to, who hasn't been fully prepped in the Victorian period, is constantly making mistakes, being too nice to the servants, you know,
actually caring about what their names are instead of just naming them all the same thing so that it's less confusing. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Or what about, we were talking about food earlier with Delicieux. What about Victorian breakfast? There's like veal and kippers. And Ned says to Verity, he says, are there going to be bacon and eggs? And she said, no, that's a lower class breakfast. And he's like, ugh. He's looking at all these things. He's like, I don't want to eat fish for breakfast. I don't want to eat curried rice.
And the whole idea of Bane, the butler, Bane who just doesn't sleep, essentially doesn't sleep. He is too busy managing all of these constant interruptions of what he's doing because they need something else. That's an interesting characterization.
And completely unrealistic expectations for Bane. You know, Bane, get the umbrella. Bane, get a new set of clothing. Bane, go find their boat. A boat has sunk. Go fish the boat out of the river and make sure everything is cleaned and ironed. And
why didn't you start the fire? I asked you to light the fire. Why aren't you lighting the fire? I'm going to do the other thing that you already told me to do. No, I have to stop and wait and light the fire first, sir.
And he's how actually accomplishes all these things. And it's so funny because if you had read Doomsday Book before and you guys are happy you didn't spend the time on it, you would know Finch. And so Finch is like the butler of 2040.
Okay.
So Finch is a very Bane character. Oxford.
That explains why I didn't understand Finch nearly as well as I did, because she uses a little bit of shorthand for Finch because he was a character in the previous book. That makes a lot of sense.
Yeah. And I think Professor Dunsworthy as well, but I think that she does explain Dunsworthy a little bit better, but we don't know butlers. So we don't have that same like, oh, Finch is the butler character.
Right.
This book has been characterized as a romp. That's one of the words that often gets used. A romp through time. And I find it very lovely and pleasant. Unlike the other three novels that are set here, which are about the bubonic plague, which of course was completely devastating, and about World War II. So this one is the funny one, the Victorian one.
Okay. It
still has some kind of like, not dark passages, but there's the feeling like in 2040, cats are extinct, you know, and that's very sad, but it's also representative of all the extinctions that we're facing in the 21st century, right? So they became extinct because of a disease, not because of, you know, anthropogenic change, but that idea of like, guys, we're losing things. And I think there are moments in this novel where Ned, especially when he's on the river and he's looking at the very places, he's looking at the Oxford of 150 years earlier, and it's so pastoral. It's so serene. And, you know, part of him is like, oh, like I don't have access to my technology, but part of him is like, this is kind of amazing, you know, this sort of nostalgia for the pastoral past. And I think that is something that we sometimes experience. We love the pace of our lives, but maybe the idea of slowing down sometimes has an attractiveness as well.
I just watched a video that was about the Zephyr train that goes between Chicago and San Francisco. And it's by Amtrak, and you get on it, and it is maybe a 2.5 day journey. You have two sleeps during this time. Okay. And one of the comments the gentleman who is our host says is that Wi-Fi is not very good out there. And what it forced him to do is to relax, to basically go up there, sit up and watch the mountains go by, watch the planes go by. And I think that you hit on something right there, is that the pace of our lives, sometimes when you go on vacation or go out for that hike or whatever that thing is, it takes 2 or 3 days before you unwind to that, mm-hmm. that point where you've unwound that, that feeling that, you know, that the day-to-day activities we do.
And I find it interesting that because this was written in 1997, she does not have a view of the technology of the future, yes. of 2040 the same way that we have now in 2022. She mentions a handheld, and she only refers to it as a handheld. There's no other modifier to that. It is a handheld. And we, as people who all own smartphones, we expect a smartphone to be that computing device that does everything. But in 1997, that was pre-smartphone. She's describing more of either a radio or a cellular phone. And there's very little reference to the World Wide Web in this, because the World Wide Web was presented in 1990 and was still a very, very new technology when she was writing this. So the idea of the net, as presented, is not the way to find information, the same idea that we have today. I find that intriguing.
Yeah. And one thing I really love about the net is that when people catch a glimpse of the portal in the 19th century, they think it's a portal to another world. And so mm-hmm. it completely justifies their belief in seances. Now, of course, you guys noticed that there's plenty of mention of both Sherlock Holmes and Hercule Poirot. And so there's lots and lots of talk about mysteries and mystery novels. And this whole science fiction, time travel, Victorian novel is also set up as a mystery. Where is the mm-hmm. bishop's bird stump, and what does it mean? And so she sets up, and the final chapter is the great revelation scene of all of those Sherlock Holmes stories that we read, of all of the Hercule Poirot stories of which we read one, where everyone's gathered together and someone explains what has happened.
Yeah, I saw what she was doing there with all of those Sherlock Holmes references from the Victorian era and the Hercule Poirot, where she's giving us the pattern that's going to happen for this mystery to be solved at the end. I did enjoy that.
And it's so meta. And you guys, like, what is with the title, which she mentions so many times? I'm just going to go out on a limb and guess that you guys have not, in fact, read Jerome K. Jerome's Three Men in a Boat.
I'm illiterate, so I mean that's just part of life. We know that now.
Pam, we've been working together long enough that you know that we have not read Three Men in a Boat.
And the subtitle of that book is To Say Nothing of the Dog. Now, mm-hmm. one of my favorite moments in this novel is when Terrence and Ned and Dr. Pettick are in their boat heading down the Thames with Cyril, their big bulldog, and they see the actual men in the boat. They see Jerome K. Jerome with his two friends and his dog. And Ned gets so distracted by, because imagine that, you guys, imagine seeing the actual people that you think of as characters, but that were real people in a novel written 150 years earlier. He gets so distracted that he totally loses. He's supposed to be steering the boat and he forgets to steer because he's looking at these guys. And people are like, be careful of the nose. And he's thinking, what's wrong with my nose? And it's the nose of the boat. Mm-hmm. And he's actually crashing the boat. And so what we get here is that this very famous moment in the Jerome K. Jerome memoir slash novel is actually happened to Ned Henry and not to Jerome K. Jerome. And so there's something so awesomely meta about it.
Yeah, I love when time travel stories can do that, can make that truth of your existence be these time travelers caused that. In my head, my science fiction time travel novel will do exactly that. It will not be people from our time need to travel back in time to fix history. They will travel back in time and create the history that we know to be true. That's what she's doing here.
Yes, yes. And I love it. And it's, again, it's one of those books where if you have the references, it's so pleasurable. And if you don't, you're just like, what?
But she hits you over the head with Three Men in a Boat. Boy, boy, oh boy, is this story about Three Men in a Boat, to say nothing of the dog. And she says it so many times that, yes, I definitely had to do some Wikipedia work on that one.
And then she really gets into the questions of like how Victorians saw the world. And it's so funny because I've become quite enamored with the history of the gene and of genetics and the fact that, having taken my last biology class 30 years ago, I don't know what the heck's happening in biology. And it's so much fascinating stuff. So I've been doing a lot of just fun reading and popular science lately. I'm reading a really interesting book by Siddhartha Mukherjee called The Gene, An Intimate History. And it was so fun for me this week that my nonfiction book melded with a fiction book that I've read a million times. And when Professor Pettick and Professor Oberforce are discussing the two views of history, this was very much a super important epistemological debate in the Victorian period. Is it great men who make history, or are there forces that are bigger than people who make history? And that kind of comes into fate versus free will. Like, are we making decisions that actually have an impact, or is everything already just fated? And those are questions at the center of any time travel narrative.
Absolutely.
And so she just pulls it out like a lot of time travel writers do. And you know, Ned thinks about it like just my only quote that I picked out from this book is Ned thinking, the problem, of course, as in so many wars, was that Professor Oberforce and Professor Pettick were both right. They were just a century too early for chaos theory, which would have incorporated both their ideas. History was indeed controlled by blind forces, as well as character and courage and treachery and love and accident and random chance and stray bullets and telegrams and tips and cats. But it was also stable. And so this idea that like in 2040, people feel like they have a handle on it, but they don't. In 2140, people are going to be looking back at 2040 thinking, what were they thinking? And so every one of us, we in 2021, think we understand the world.
That's your Michael Crichton reference, Chip.
Well, there you go.
It's all chaos. And then there comes the running and the screaming.
So epistemologically, it's very, very pleasant.
Yes. I can't say that I didn't like this book, Pam. I liked this book. I did not love this book. I'm not sure that I would recommend it to the people that enjoy the time travel genre, because I think it focuses so much on the Victorian and not as much on the mechanics of time travel and the history bending, although that is certainly in there. What do you think, Chip?
Sure. I'm stretching as you talk. I'm like, sure.
So, Pam, when you read this with your next book club, please report back how ignorant we are, and please tell them
that these two dullards were not enjoying this as much as we'd like them to. We shall look at them with disdain.
Thank you for bringing us this book, Pam. I look forward to what we're going to choose for our February book in the busiest time of year. February is just so busy. I hope we find something that we can all enjoy, and maybe something shorter.
The next time I think about
War and Peace.
We can think of something shorter. I hear you.
It's going to be the original Russian.
Wonderful. That was To Say Nothing of the Dog, published in 1997 by Connie Willis.
Scroll with it.
brings us to our scroll with it. Boy, Chip, it has been a tough week for losses in the entertainment industry.
It certainly has. In fact, what we're seeing is a whole group of people. I mean, we lost Bob Saget a couple of weeks ago, Steve. Mm-hmm. Betty White lives forever.
I agree with that. I completely agree that the entertainment industry makes for forever. These people who are lost to us, we still have them with all of their work that they did.
And what's interesting is it reminds us, and in fact, this is where when celebrities pass away, really can impact you. You recognize that you were introduced to them at some point and you followed their life. And life is short, and it looks like Louis Anderson has passed away.
Yeah, Louis Anderson, a fantastic stand-up comedian. He became an actor. He turned Family Feud host for a small amount of time. He passed away this week. He was 68.
He couldn't kiss as well as Richard Dawson, Steve.
My favorite Louis Anderson is the Life with Louis cartoon. That was 1994 to 1998. Is an autobiographical story of his childhood with his father. And I just love those stories.
Well, we lost Richard Corbin, the artist for Bat Out of Hell, two Decembers ago. And it looks like we just lost Meatloaf too, Steve.
Yeah, this one hit me hard. Meatloaf has been a big part of my musical taste for all my life and my movie taste, because Meatloaf was in the Rocky Horror Picture Show in 1975, and he released Bat Out of Hell in 1977, and then the sequel in 1993 when I was in college. And boy, Meatloaf's music speaks to me a lot.
Well, two out of three ain't bad, Steve.
Speaking of which, I would have said there were only two Bat Out of Hells, but there is a third one.
And welcome to the neighborhood.
Back to listen to it. I knew all of those songs. So I guess I did listen to the third one, even though I hadn't really remembered. Now, one of the things I always found interesting about Meatloaf was that he was a vegan for about a decade of his life when he was younger, which just wasn't something I would have associated.
Oh, come on. You've heard of a vegan Meatloaf.
I actually do. That's make vegan meatloaf, believe it or not. I love it.
It's beyond meat.
I never got to meet Meatloaf.
Impossible.
I really wish that I had the opportunity to shake his hand and thank him for all of his contributions to my existence, really. He was supposed to be on the convention circuit in 2022, but unfortunately he will not be there for us.
Meatloaf was peak sweaty 70s, Steve.
Yeah, he was definitely a different, unusual rock and roll star, huh? His stage persona inspired so many people to get out there and do it, because he certainly did not fit that stereotype.
Well, his sweat glands certainly worked real well.
One of my favorite lines from him is, "I wasn't built for comfort, I was built for speed." That like embodies Meatloaf, right?
Like, Steve, you've got exciting news, because it looks like that Harry Potter is going to be helping you out.
You're a Weird Al, Harry. Yes. Daniel Radcliffe is going to star as Weird Al Yankovic in a movie that Weird Al is creating for himself, an autobiopic that's going to hit our Rokus in hopefully 2022.
Have you seen the Funny or Die skit that kind of led this?
The original version of this idea of weird, yes. The Weird Al story? Yes. Yes.
This is very funny.
Leading to a full-blown autobiopic. I look forward to that one strongly.
And one of my favorite society commentators, Mike Judge, seems to be coming back, Steve.
Damn it, Bobby. King of the Hill is coming back to TV. I am super excited about that. Remember when we met Joel Adams, the designer of those characters, and talked to him about how he designed the King of the Hill characters?
Well, there'll be a lot of talk about propane and propane accessories, Steve.
Damn it, Bobby. Apple TV is producing a Godzilla television series. The kaiju fans out there are screaming. Screaming in a good way this time.
Does that mean people will start getting Apple TV Plus, Steve?
No, this is yet another Apple TV Plus thing that certain people will watch this.
It is an app, but yeah, whether people actually buy it off the Apple TV or another service, we'll never know. Steve, there's a lot of hot games going on. Fill us in to the hottest.
This week, boy, oh boy, have my social media feeds been full of Wordle. This is the new game. Not new. This is not a new game. This is an old game that somebody caught on to, and it's what everybody's talking about this week. Right, Pam?
I'm enjoying it.
So can you describe Wordle for us?
Sure. It's a mastermind game. So you guess a five-letter word, and it tells you if the letter's in the word, and if it's in the correct place, and then you have six guesses to find your five-letter word for the day. One thing that's really fun about it is that there's only one Wordle per day. So you can't just start doing like 40 Wordles in a row. You get one Wordle every morning, and people like, you know, share their success without the words being shown on like, you know, all sorts of social media feeds. So
now, is this the reason why my Farmville crew keeps going away?
Oh, Farmville. Oh, my mother played Farmville every day. And when they shut down Farmville, my mother's eyes were open to the world around her because she didn't have to spend all of her time on her farm. Wordle has been great. The story of its creation is a fascinating story. A man named Josh Wardle made this tiny little JavaScript program for his wife as a daily exercise in wordplay, and gave it to his wife as a gift and left it open on the internet. And the rest of the internet found it, and it's become the hot new thing. And there's no money behind it. There's no sponsorship. He's not making money on this tiny little app. It just exists out there.
Well, isn't that a special gift?
Mm-hmm. The bad news is a lot of people are going to start cloning Wordle, and somebody's going to find a way to make money on it. This week, a new version of Wordle came out called Loodle. This is a five-letter naughty word game. So all of your five-letter naughty words that are going through your head right now, those will help you play Loodle this week. I don't know, Chip. I think we have enough information to survive another week. What do you think?
Only if we can come back next week, Steve.
What do you think, Pam?
Only if I can come back next month, if you'll have me and my long Victorian books.
We are going to find a shorter book that may or may not be Victorian for February. I'll tell you that much.
Dr. Seuss? Oh, my God.
We're going to take a deep dive into the literature of Dr. Seuss. There's a cat and a hat.
And it's all a metaphor, my friends. It's all a metaphor. It's
the epistemological ramifications of... Thank you, Professor.
Don't even make fun of that idea. It's a good idea.
We would love to hear from you. Give us a call or a text. Our phone number is 805-4104-TMS. Our website is toomuchscrolling.com. Our email is toomuchscrolling@gmail.com. We're on Twitter and Instagram and Facebook. We're on Spotify and Apple Podcasts and YouTube. And you can always ask your smart speaker to play the latest episode of Too Much Scrolling. I want to thank you again for listening to Too Much Scrolling. I'm Steve Fodor.
I'm Chip Hassenflaw.
And I'm Pam Vidor.
We'll see you in the future.
And the past.
Because it's all time travel. Because that's all Steve ever reads.